This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Ryan Lizza has an article in the current edition of The New Yorker about how the uprisings in North Africa have remade President Obama's foreign policy. The article examines the disagreements between the State Department, Defense Department, and the White House, and the conflicting priorities of the so-called idealists and realists within the administration. Last month, Lizza traveled with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to Cairo and Tunisia. He's a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker and profiled Obama during the 2008 presidential campaign. Ryan Lizza, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want to start with the very end of your article. Your article ends by quoting an advisor to Obama, describing President Obama's leadership style as leading from behind. This phrase has really been reverberating in the internet in ways that you maybe didn't expect.
Yes.
So what did that advisor mean by that phrase? How did you interpret it, leading from behind, when you published it?
The way that the president approached Libya is a great example of what his advisor described as leading from behind. Since the end of the Cold War, one of the fundamental facts about international relations has been a growing backlash against the biggest actor in the world, and that is the United States. And that really peaked in the Bush era. And so when Obama and his team came into office, this was something that they were acutely aware of, that the U.S. had to operate in the world in a way that didn't foment backlash, and especially, of all places, in the Middle East. And so when they approached what to do about Libya, when they approached the question of could and should the United States intervene militarily in another Muslim country, how could we do it without it seeming like Iraq or like any of the other places in the Middle East where our presence is hurting our reputation? And that's where leading from behind comes in. It's actually, I've learned this subsequently through the beauty of the internet, another leader who's used the term leading from behind is Nelson Mandela. A lot of people on the right have interpreted this as not leading, and I don't think that that's what this advisor meant by it, and I certainly don't think that's what Obama did in the case of Libya. What it means is getting other actors out front, not stamping the intervention in Libya with the American brand.
So give us an example from the Obama administration's approach to taking action in Libya, something that exemplifies leading from behind.
Well, I would say, one, making sure, really highlighting and emphasizing the fact that Arab states were calling for intervention, specifically the Arab League. But if you look at what the Arab League and other Arab states were asking for, is they were asking for a no-fly zone. If you look closely at what the United States pushed for, it was not a no-fly zone. The Obama administration determined that a no-fly zone would be useless. Simply preventing Gaddafi's airplanes from being in the air would do nothing to save Benghazi. And what they actually did is they went to the UN and they took a resolution that was being proposed by the UK and the French, and they said, this won't do it. We need a resolution that gives us all necessary means, UN language, for any military force that's required to save Benghazi. So they moved, you know, to put it one way, they moved the entire debate in a more interventionist, more militaristic direction. And yet at the same time, didn't really highlight that. I mean, they were very quiet about it. A lot of the accounts in the press barely pointed this out. And, you know, I think a lot of Americans are used to the president making a big splashy announcement on the at the White House when we do something like this. And they did it in this sort of stealth, quiet way, emphasizing Arab leadership, Arab requests, multilateralism, all the rest.
Arab
League support. And frankly, there was a lot of criticism from the right that, oh, the French, how could we let the French be leading on this? And I think to some of Obama's advisors, that's not the worst thing in the world. Their view is that they inherited a United States that was economically weaker, militarily dragged down by wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that burden sharing was something that they should look forward to, and not something that in some way demeans the United States. And I think that's what you're seeing in this debate since that quote has become public. It's a lot of people on the right who feel like leading from behind is not leading.
Yes, well, let me just read a quote that exemplifies this, and this is a quote from John Podhoretz in the conservative political publication Commentary. He writes, "The crystallizing phrase, leading from behind, may not be something you'll see on a sign at the 2012 Democratic Convention, but it will almost certainly be in the acceptance speech of the nominee of the Republican Party at its 2012 convention, and will be thrown in Obama's face during the presidential debates by his GOP rival, and will be the centerpiece of the critique of Obamaism going forward. It's so revealing, in fact, that I wouldn't be surprised if the White House goes on a hunt to find the person who said it in order to defenestrate him before he does more colossal damage to his boss's chances of re-election. Leading from behind. Oh, boy." So that's the quote.
That's the quote. And that's been a common reaction of a lot of conservatives. And I do think it's very it does crystallize the different ways that Republicans and Democrats view foreign policy. And a lot of Republicans believe that the United States, that worrying about backlash and worrying about resentment of how the U.S. acts in the world, that's overrated and that's not really a problem. The Obama administration takes it very seriously. So I think I knew that quote was going to cause a bit of a fuss, because it really gets at something very central to the way that the two parties view foreign policy.
So if you're just joining us, my guest is Ryan Lizza, and he's the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. We're talking about his new article in The New Yorker, The Consequentialist, How the Arab Spring Remade Obama's Foreign Policy. So let's continue with Libya here. You say Libya is the first major issue that Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, and Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense, disagreed. What was their disagreement about?
Well, Gates, as he said publicly, that Libya was not in the vital interest of the United States. And if it's not in the vital interest, then you have the question of, well, you have a humanitarian crisis on our hands, the crisis being that Gaddafi's forces were on the outskirts of Benghazi, and Gaddafi and his sons were publicly saying that they were going to go house to house to find these rebels. So you had a pretty convincing case that there was that an imminent massacre was going to take place. And if you're Bob Gates, you know, the world is a very ugly place with lots of bad things that happen, and it's not the United States' job to intervene every time something like that happens, even if we can. Clinton comes out of a very different tradition. One of the things that the Bill Clinton White House was known for was its development of a policy of humanitarian intervention. And I think one of the things that both Clintons are extremely tormented by are the cases where they didn't intervene, specifically Rwanda. Anyway, this is something, I think, in Hillary Clinton's blood, and she, as did other people in the Obama administration, made a powerful case that even though that Libya was not in our vital interest, even though Libya is not, you know, Saudi Arabia, for instance, or a place where we have deep ties or economic interests, we had a responsibility to protect the citizens of Benghazi, essentially. And that was as clear-cut a case as you can get between idealists and realists. Although I will say this, there was another argument that was made by Clinton and others and like-minded officials, and that is what's going on in the wider Middle East, this uprising, this democratic uprising, is impacted by how the United States acts in every country. And it's important for the United States to be standing with this democratic movement, and that by siding with the rebels and even intervening militarily, that sent a message to other countries on whose side we were in this broader battle that's going on. And that is indeed in our interests.
Now, the UN resolution that you referred to earlier is the first time that the UN authorized military action to preempt an imminent massacre. Would you say that Hillary Clinton won this debate over Robert Gates in terms of what to do in Libya?
I do, although I think, as I reported this out, I think that it's much less a which Hillary Clinton pushed anyone into this, but that Barack Obama made this decision. And that that the crucial player here is not any single member of his cabinet, but is the president himself, because it was the president who was presented with. Essentially, there was a very important meeting where he got an intelligence briefing about the situation on the ground in Libya. And at that point, he was told that Gaddafi's troops were about to take a city not far from Benghazi. And as soon as they took that city, they would be able to cut off the fuel and water to Benghazi. And that Benghazi being the sort of home, the sort of capital of the rebellion, that everything, the whole situation would be over within 48 hours, and what he would do in Benghazi did not, wasn't going to be pretty. And so the president asked, well, okay, the solution to this problem that's on the table at the UN right now is a no-fly zone. Is that going to stop the situation that you guys just outlined to me? And he was told, no, it wouldn't do anything.
In part because Gaddafi was using tanks, not more than planes. Yeah.
He was using tanks, and Gaddafi was watching the international debate, right? He was watching the world debate a no-fly zone, so he wasn't using planes anymore because he realized at any minute the UN could decide to bomb his air defenses and take out his planes. And so the no-fly zone simply became a moot point as he closed in on Benghazi. So the important actor really is President Obama. It's President Obama saying we need a solution that'll actually deal with how the situation on the ground has changed.
And what was the new resolution?
The new resolution authorized all necessary means, which is UN language for do whatever it takes to protect the citizens. This was so surprising. This is where we get back to the leading from behind. So there was this 48-hour period before the UN resolution gets, the new U.S. version of this resolution gets proposed, where the French and the British were just scratching their heads, wondering what is going on in this White House? Where is this president? Hillary Clinton, I was with her in Paris, and she had meetings with Sarkozy. She had meetings with representatives of the rebels from Libya. And they left these meetings, and both Sarkozy and the rebels were pushing for this UN resolution. And she didn't have an official U.S. position yet. The White House was still divided on this issue. So the whole world was, at this moment, Terry, was sort of waiting for what the United States was going to decide on this issue. And finally, the decision is made, and they go to the UN, and instead of supporting what's on the table, they expand the resolution greatly. So the French and the British were so shocked by this that they actually, one of the French diplomats told me that they thought it was a trick. They thought that the United States wasn't serious about this, and they thought that they were expanding the resolution so that the Chinese and the Russians and some Muslim countries would turn against the resolution and kill it. That's how surprised they were by the way that the United States sort of flipped in those 48 hours. Now, they very quickly realized that that wasn't the case, that the United States government did a sort of all-out diplomatic offensive to pass the new resolution. But that's how fast the situation changed.
The Obama administration also hasn't wanted to be in the lead in the military action.
Well, that's exactly right. And, there is this view, and I think this view flows partly from Obama's national security advisor, Tom Donilon. I think it is partly from Gates and no doubt from Obama himself. And just to take a step back, the view is that we have been, as Donilon told me, overweighted in the Middle East and underweighted in what a lot of Obama officials believe is the most important region to the United States' future, and that is Asia. So the grand plan of the Obama administration has been wind down the war in Iraq, wind down the war in Afghanistan, and try and turn our attention and engagement to Asia, where a lot of countries believe that we have been, in the Bush years, we weren't focused there much. This has been a huge priority for Hillary Clinton, for example. A lot of her diplomacy and time has been spent engaging with Asian countries that, for economic reasons, will be very important to our future. And yet, what has happened over the last couple of years is that instead of this grand rebalancing, as they call it, we keep getting stuck in the Middle East. And you know, that's one of the ways in which the president's plan on his first day in office has been in some ways thwarted by events on the ground.
And a lot of people are describing the situation in Libya now as a standoff.
And every week that the rebels seem like they just can't finish the job and their gains seem to be reversed by Gaddafi brings a new call for more help. And Obama laid down this principle early on that we would have no boots on the ground, that our own role would be extremely limited. Again, leading from behind, let others shoulder some of the burden here. And what's going to happen, though, is more and more there'll be countries that say, well, the United States is the only one that can do X, Y, or Z, and the potential that will be more and more involved there.
So a lot of your piece about President Obama's foreign policy is about the divisions within his team between the realists and the idealists, the idealists being the people who emphasize human rights and democracy, and the realists are you know, people who are asking, like, what are our interests in the country? What's the end game? Do we really want to commit militarily here? Mm-hmm. So some people have said, well, this is really like a gender division within the White House, with the idealists being the women like Samantha Power and Anne Marie Slaughter and sometimes Hillary Clinton, you know, arguing for intervention to prevent a massacre, and the realists being the men. Do you see a gender division in the White House?
I was very skeptical of that analysis going into the piece, but it did come up. It did come up on a couple of occasions. You know, this gendered argument about some of the male members of the team being more interested in hard power and great power relationships, and some of the female members of the team being much more conversant in soft power and relationships, not just with states but with societies. And look, this came, you know, what I report in the piece is this argument was openly discussed by Anne Marie Slaughter, who was head of policy planning at the State Department, and she gave a speech on her last day at the State Department, her farewell speech, and she made exactly the argument that I just recited. She said that there was a gender divide between the realists and the idealists, between the people who think and talk mostly in terms of U.S. interests and those who think and talk more in terms of U.S. values. So, you know, look, I talked to people at the White House about this, and you know, they told me this was outlandish. And so it's a very difficult accusation to get to the bottom of.
So, you know, meanwhile, we've been talking about Libya. Syria is erupting now. There have been massive protests. Hundreds of people have been killed by the military. The military is remaining loyal so far, anyways, to President Bashar al-Assad. And the president has been more brutal, I think, than a lot of people expected. So, again, the Obama administration is faced with a really difficult decision about what, if anything, to do in Syria. So do you think that the calculus here is different from what the calculus has been in other countries? Are the divisions within the Obama administration the same?
Obama's view of Syria and Iran, two countries that are allied with one another, his theory was that Assad was probably a reasonable person. Assad is this Western-educated, he speaks fluent French and English. For 11 years in office, people have constantly made the argument that as bad as the Syrian regime is, Assad himself may be someone who you can peel away from Iran, who you can engage with and get him to align more with the West. And so the big priority in Syria has been to restart Israeli-Syrian peace negotiations, and it has been to peel away Assad from his Iranian benefactors. That strategy has basically ended now. I mean, you can't, you know, it's very hard to do that with a regime that is shooting its people in the streets.
You traveled with Secretary of State Clinton last month to Cairo and Tunisia, and this was after the uprisings,
Yes.
after the uprisings. And let's talk about Egypt. Hillary Clinton was scheduled to meet with one of the youth revolutionary groups, and they boycotted the meeting with her.
Yeah, this was really fascinating, Harry. These guys, and these were very important actors. They were, they're sometimes just known as the coalition, but they really were the young leaders who are credited with starting the revolution in Egypt. And what I was fascinated to learn is how closely they watched and listened to what American officials said about what they were doing. And this is really, really important because I think one of the very valid criticisms of the Obama administration is that when President Obama came into office, he was extremely sensitive to the idea of the U.S. meddling or interfering with these kinds of movements abroad. And I think that instinct, there's something very valid about it, because very often regimes use U.S. support for these movements to crush the movement, right? But I think he may have done it to a fault. And I found in the course of reporting that there was some regret over the handling of the Iranian Revolution, for instance, that they thought that Obama's posture of non-interference went too far, to the point where we didn't actually show that it could have been helpful if we showed a little bit more support to the democratic protesters. So in Egypt, they had, in a sense, a chance to get that balance right. And I learned when I was in Egypt talking to these protesters that that really mattered to people on the ground. It really was important to them where the United States stood. Now, Egypt's a different case, of course, because the United States was Mubarak's friend. So that was, it was crucial to know whether we were going to stand with Mubarak or stand with the protesters in Tahrir Square. And so these young protesters decided that Hillary Clinton's statement very early on in the protests, she made a statement that the Mubarak regime is stable. Now, objectively, it wasn't an incorrect statement. The Mubarak regime was stable. But the protesters, this was burned into their memories as Hillary Clinton supporting the Mubarak regime. And that was the reason they cited most often to me, or at least the four members of the coalition who I met with who boycotted her meeting. That was the reason that they cited for boycotting her meeting.
And then you told that to Hillary Clinton. What did she have to
yes.
say?
Yes. Yeah, because I was meeting with these guys at the same time she was meeting with other members of civil society. So she was upstairs in her meeting, and these guys were meeting downstairs, boycotting her meeting, meeting with me and a couple of other reporters. She was really sort of realistic about it. I mean, she pointed out that she was involved with protest movements when she was younger. She talked about her work against the Vietnam War and how in every revolution, every protest, there are people who take absolutist positions and boycott this or that meeting. She didn't really seem too bothered about it, to be honest. And she very pointedly said, Ryan, the people who start revolutions are not necessarily the same people who go on to run the country. And her takeaway, one of the things that came up in our interview, I interviewed her the following day when she was in Tunisia. Her takeaway was she was very worried about what was going on in terms of the transition in Cairo, because there's no recent history of political engagement, of party building, and the people that she met with, she found very disorganized and not quite ready for the elections that were coming, and she was very worried about that, and partly because the one group that is very organized is the Muslim Brotherhood.
I heard an interview on Morning Edition this week with Mohamed El-Baradei, who is running for president, but says he's not going to run if the democratic infrastructure falls apart. And he's concerned that there's not enough time for new parties to pull together, that the election is really coming a little too soon.
Yeah, that's a big concern. And that's a big concern. And the folks that could most take advantage of quick elections are the Muslim Brotherhood or the old party or members of Mubarak's old party. And, one other anecdote from that trip that I thought was so revealing about the way that folks in that region of the world see our statesmen, and that is that I sat there with these four young people, and one of them was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood.
This is one of the revolutionary youth.
Yes, one of the members of the protest movement. One of them was two of them described themselves as liberals. One of them described himself as a Marxist, and one as a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I asked this this young man from the Muslim Brotherhood, if Barack Obama were upstairs right now, would you meet with him? And his face lit up and he said, yes, I would. And they saw, and all four of them saw Obama's public statements as getting it right. They saw his statement, when, especially when he said that Mubarak, that the transition, I don't know if you remember this, but at one point Obama said the transition needs to happen now. And that was a very encouraging sign. But anyway, their takeaway from Obama's handling of that crisis was that he was on their side. Now, from my reporting, I frankly don't think that, that Secretary Clinton and Obama were very far apart on this issue, but these public statements stick in people's minds. And it did strike me, we talked a lot about this when Obama was a candidate, about how just having a guy named Barack Hussein Obama, an African-American with that name, that that itself would have a big influence on the way that people in that region of the world see us. And that came through in some of my conversations with these activists, that they can relate to Obama in a way that they haven't related to previous American presidents, and that they certainly related to him more during that crisis than they did with Secretary Clinton.
How much credit do you think the United States takes, the Obama administration takes, for pushing Mubarak out of office? Remember that speech in Tahrir Square where everybody thought he was going to resign? Everybody was prepared for him to say, stepping down, you know, I got to leave, and he didn't. And then he left shortly afterwards. But it was such a bizarre speech, and he was so confusing in that speech. And everybody, of course, was wondering, what's the Obama administration doing with him behind the scenes? I'd love to know what went on in those hours. Do you have any idea?
Here's what I was able to piece together, because I had the exact same questions. What my understanding is that there were people in the Obama administration who were very hung up on a sort of technical matter, and that is the Egyptian constitution. So if the United States really early on pushed hard and for Mubarak to resign, this document, which I don't think anyone was really an expert on until this crisis and didn't really seem to matter much, the Egyptian constitution, it called for the Speaker of the Egyptian Parliament to take over the presidency. Well, it turns out that the Speaker of the Egyptian Parliament is a pretty bad guy, and the Obama administration was, you know, horrified by the idea that this guy would suddenly become president of Egypt. It didn't seem that that's what the protesters in Tahrir Square wanted, and it didn't seem like it was in anyone's interest to do that. So they were looking for a solution that would essentially keep Mubarak as president, where you could have his signature to change the constitution or to implement whatever scheme you needed to implement to get a transitional government set up. And that early on seemed was the sort of favored position of many of the members of the administration. And this is frankly something that Mubarak was saying to American officials, and that he was pushing as well. He was telling them, look, I can't resign because this guy's going to take over and you don't want that guy to take over. And so when he gave that speech, if you read it carefully, it was this meandering, strange speech, but embedded in that speech are a couple of lines where Mubarak does sort of hint at this constitutional issue, and he hints at how he's going to stick around a little longer to make the necessary changes. But that's not how it came out, and that's not how the protesters in Tahrir heard it. And so as their demands became more maximalist, as the protesters in Tahrir Square, as their demands became more maximalist and they demanded his resignation, it became increasingly untenable for the Obama administration to pursue this sort of soft landing for Mubarak, where he is technically president but sort of helps implement this nice, smooth transition to democracy. And Obama made the decision basically after watching Mubarak's speech during a national security meeting at the White House that he was going to call Mubarak, sort of take his temperature, and then make his own public statement. And I got a pretty lengthy readout on his call with Mubarak, at least President Obama's side of the call. And he went back and forth with Mubarak, you know, can you make these constitutional changes? You know, can you set up a transitional government? And the feeling from the White House was that Mubarak simply wasn't going to be responsive. He didn't understand how serious that the protesters were. He didn't understand the pressure he was under. And I think that's the moment where they sort of abandon Mubarak to a certain extent.
And they abandoned Mubarak, maybe a little, yeah. Then what? Did they say to him, you've got to go or else?
Well, this is this is a really important question, Terry, historically. And my understanding is that on that phone call, the president of the United States never told Mubarak, you immediately have to resign. Now, remember, at that point, they had already asked him to announce that he would not run for president. So they had accomplished that, and they did push him towards that. But the White House's view of that of Obama's last phone call with Mubarak is that the president, while not using the words, you have to resign as president, all but told Mubarak that that was the message they were sending. I think it's slightly opaque, but certainly the readout I have from that call is that that's the signal that they were sending, that there's got to be a graceful way, that just announcing that you're not going to run for re-election isn't enough, that the protesters in Tahrir Square are demanding more, and we need to find a solution that pushes you off the stage. Now, what accomplished that, I think, in a much more dramatic fashion was the public statement that Obama made after he talked to Mubarak. And he says that the transition needs to begin now. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but in the Middle East, that was an earthquake. And as one State Department official told me, the people around Mubarak got extremely angry after that statement. And they interpreted this as a real break between Obama and Mubarak. And the Saudis and other regional allies interpreted this as a very aggressive statement. If you're Saudi Arabia, you're sitting there thinking, wow, the United States just overthrew a friend of 30 years. If we get into trouble, will they do that to us as well?
Obama has been described as not having a foreign policy doctrine.
Yeah.
Some people
yeah.
think that's a good thing. It means he's flexible. Yes. And other people think that's a bad thing. It means he hasn't thought it through. He doesn't have a system. He doesn't have a
yes.
context. The title of your article is The Consequentialist, which is how some of his aides have described his foreign policy style. He's a consequentialist. So
yes.
what does that mean?
Well, it basically means that he wants to do what works, right? He doesn't care about whether it's realist or idealist. It's at the end of the day, what are the consequences of the action and what are the effects? That effects matter more than ideology. And you're so right about this view of doctrine and whether it's good to have a doctrine or bad to have a doctrine. And I talked to a lot of people about this to sort of get some sort of historical perspective on whether doctrines are good or bad for presidents. You know, on the one hand, you'll find people who say, doctrines are the worst thing. As soon as you lay down a doctrine, you're hemming yourself in. You're limiting your choices. You don't want to lay down doctrines. You don't want to lay down ironclad rules for how the U.S. operates in the world, because that will put a straitjacket on your ability to maneuver. Other folks say, well, you have to have some broad principles. You know, whether you call that a doctrine or not, you have to have something that some compass that guides your foreign policy. Otherwise, everything is ad hoc, and how you act in one case doesn't relate well to how you act in another case.
Ryan Lizza is a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. His article about how the Arab Spring remade President Obama's foreign policy is in the current edition. You'll find a link to it on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Emmylou Harris's new album, Hard Bargain. She first came to prominence in the early 70s for her work with country rock pioneer Gram Parsons. Her new album includes a new song about her days with Parsons, as well as a tribute to her late friend, the singer-songwriter Kate McGarrigle. This is one of her new songs from the album. It's called Home Sweet Home.
Emmylou Harris sings with a steadfast purity that can be starkly beautiful. It can also be coldly distancing. Over the years, her public image has coalesced around the idea of a serene singer-songwriter whose elegance and wisdom is signaled by her immaculate silver-gray hair. One thing I'm trying to say here is that it takes a lot to get a rise out of Emmylou, but producer Jay Joyce has succeeded. You can hear it in the way he's collaborated with her on a song such as New Orleans, a rare flood tide of emotion set to a drum-slamming, upbeat, rare for Harris, and Welcome. Harris is in a nostalgic mood on The Road, a song addressed to Graham Parsons, with whom she made a couple of excellent albums, Grievous Angel and Sleepless Nights. Parsons recognized that her surging harmonies worked well in contrast to his own bellful croon. For her part, Harris acknowledges in The Road that Parsons pushed her to be more daring in every way.
I can still remember every song you played long ago. And we rocked the night away. How could I see a future then where you would not grow with such a fire in our belly, such a hunger in our soul? I guess I probably loved you when those words rolled off your tongue. It seemed that we were trailing under some old and no one was to blame. But the road we shared together once will never be the same.
The Road is one of two songs on this album addressed to a friend who's gone. The other is Darlin' Kate, a fond farewell to the great singer-songwriter Kate McGarrigal, who died of cancer last year. Harris's choice of poetic language may verge on the trite. Even The Simpsons and Ronald Reagan have appropriated John Gillespie McGee's phrase, slipped the surly bonds of earth. But it's the ache in Harris's voice that delivers the true emotion.
So it's finally come. You have left this world, but we'll miss our Kate, our darling girl. We held your hand, kissed your love around, and bid farewell. You're sailing now, free from the pain. You laid that burden down, but your strong and giving heart will surely be your crown. As you slip the surly bonds of earth and sail, until then, there's nothing we can do but wait to see once more our darling Kate.
Hard Bargain is certainly the most eclectic and loose-fitting album Emmylou Harris has made in a long time. There are weak spots on this album. Her song about Emmett Till doesn't work as either folk blues or as social commentary. The plaintive Lonely Girl is Harris in a drippy moment. But give her a song as crisp and direct as Ron Sexsmith's title tune, and Emmylou can still pay off on a musical hard bargain.
I'm a bit run down, but I'm okay. Just feel like calling it a day. But you send me back to the stars.
At this point in her career, Harris is a sacrosanct folky Madonna, a small M Madonna to be sure. She'll always have her devoted core following that values her mannerliness and purity. But an album as lively as Hard Bargain deserves a wider audience. It benefits, I'm guessing, from having been recorded in just 1 month. It's less fussy, more invigorating and inviting than most of what Harris has sung since she first started out with Graham Parsons.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Hard Bargain, the new album from Emmylou Harris. You can hear the complete album on the website nprmusic.org. The critically acclaimed American writer David Foster Wallace committed suicide in September 2008. In the 2.5 years since his death, publishers have released 4 unusual posthumous books under his name, including his unfinished novel, The Pale King, which was just published. Our critic at large, John Powers, is reading The Pale King and says it's gotten him thinking about why people can't seem to get enough of Wallace.
Writers love to grumble about the popularity of self-help books. Yet, like everyone else, they're always looking for someone who will teach them how to live. Just think of all those guys who learned masculinity from Hemingway, or those classy-sounding books with titles like How Proust Can Change Your Life, or How to Live, A Life of Montaigne. One who seemed to know life's secret was David Foster Wallace, whose suicide, oddly enough, only enhanced his stature as a sage. Whether or not he was the most important American writer of his era, he's certainly the one who inspired the deepest affection in life, and who in death has come to be seen as something of a literary saint. Even those who don't actually like his writing like the idea of him. Enough so that publishers keep releasing posthumous books. The latest is The Pale King, an unfinished novel about the IRS, boredom, and the mind-killing horror of bureaucracy. Skillfully stitched together by his editor, the novel has some superb sections. For instance, a tenderly observant story about 2 young Christians dealing with an unwanted pregnancy. Then again, some parts are so dull we assume that, had Wallace lived, he surely would have cut or improved them. It's a reasonable assumption. Wallace was an amazing writer whose head was exploding with perceptions, ideas, facts, and doubts about those perceptions, ideas, and facts, which is why his writing is thicketed with brainy, sometimes hilarious footnotes. Reading him, you feel engaged with a mind that is itself engaged with the fundamental question of the modern condition: how to be sane and compassionate in the face of daily life's often overwhelming craziness or tedium. That's the explicit theme of This Is Water, the text of his acclaimed 2005 commencement address at Kenyon College, a small classic of American literature that actually is a kind of self-help book. Most readers prefer Wallace's journalistic pieces, many of which filled me with envy at their originality. He had a staggering eye for detail, an ability to make startling connections, and a mind that was never predictable. He wrote brilliant and admiring pieces on David Lynch, Roger Federer, and John McCain, not exactly your ordinary egghead trifecta. When Gourmet magazine sent him to cover the Maine Lobster Festival, Wallace covered it splendidly. But he startled the editors by turning in a piece that made eating a lobster seem kind of, well, wrong. It's still the best piece I've read about the morality of eating meat. Best because it's not preachy. Wallace himself ate and enjoyed meat, but he makes us think, really think, about what it actually means to do so. If his journalism goes down easy as ice cream, his fiction was always demanding, especially Infinite Jest, a huge dystopian vision of the near future that set the standard for a whole literary generation. Here was the landmark novel other writers wanted to emulate, or top, or maybe tear down. Where many of his peers wrote books that felt dinky, Wallace strove to capture the very essence of our time: the information overload, the power of big institutions to deform our souls, and the way, in a world of seemingly endless possibilities, we can become imprisoned inside our restless brains, aimlessly shuffling thoughts and worries and dreams of escape. Now, Wallace's fiction isn't always enjoyable. It often reminds me of the films of Jean-Luc Godard, which can bore you comatose 1 minute and then moments later wow you with an epiphany that forever changes your way of thinking. Although his novels aren't emotionally satisfying like those of his friend Jonathan Franzen, the crowd-pleasing Truffaut to his radical Godard, he was his generation's genius, the voice other writers heard in their heads. This may make him sound pretentious, yet the reason people loved and still revere him is that he wasn't. He wasn't Olympian like Nabokov, self-promoting like Mailer, or reclusive like Salinger. He had a reputation, rare among famous writers, as a decent guy who genuinely cared about being good. He also cared about truth. That's why he disliked being treated as a guru or prophet or saint. He never pretended to know all the answers. In fact, with his scruffy beard, bandana, and informal manner, Wallace seemed to want nothing more than to be a regular American, just like you and me. It was always his blessing and his curse that he couldn't be.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You'll find links to nonfiction pieces by David Foster Wallace on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross.